everybody. Hope you had a good Christmas and New Year. This is Craig from theoneliner.com, and as usual with me tonight in Glasgow, there's Scott Morris.
Hello.
And also over the wonders of the wonderful Skype, wonderful Drew Tavendale in Falkirk.
Ahoy, hoy.
Was that enough wonderfuls for you?
Plenty.
Excellent.
We've had a bit of a hiatus over Christmas, you might have noticed we're gone, and being as it's Christmas, we thought we would have a look at, well, Western films.
makes sense
to me. Yeah, we were thinking that lately, since we saw 3:10 to Yuma, it seemed to be the new hotness, that it was time we investigated these claims of a Western genre revival. So we're going to have a little chat now about some films you may have seen lately, and some which you may not have seen, but after we have a little chat about them, hey, I wouldn't be surprised if you want to catch up on them. First off, the film which started the ball rolling would be Unforgiven. Scott, recap for the listeners just exactly what that's all about.
Yeah, well, maybe not quite the start of the Renaissance. You'd probably have to go back to Dances with Wolves for that. But 1992 sees Clint Eastwood directing David Webb Peoples, who did the screenplay for Blade Runner. It's a story of Bill Money, who is played by Eastwood as well. An ex-varmint who's reformed his ways and started a family, but fallen on hard times, so ends up doing the ever-tricky one last job. He teams up with his old friend Ned, who's played by Morgan Freeman, and the Schofield kid, Jamie Wolverts, to track down and kill some cowpokes who had assaulted a hooker in a drunken rage. The hookers had bound together to offer a bounty on these cowboys, much to Sheriff Little Bill Daggett's displeasure, and you don't want to incur Gene Hackman's displeasure. Daggett runs off the other would-be bounty hunters, including Richard Harris as English Bob, so a little more than a cameo, but a very, very memorable one. Money wrestles with his conscience and the ineptitude of the Schofield kid as he tries to complete his Hobson's choice to allow him to provide for his family. While this story is not providing any massive deviations on the kind of westerns that went before it, it's maybe the only one I can think of off the top of my head that features a main character who starts off redeemed and then gradually descends back into the dark side as it goes on. What it does instead is throw three of the best character actors together in a bag, jumble them up until the distilled excellence pours out of the other side. Again, a pacing, slow burning and deliberate, as with so many of the great westerns, but not in a way that makes it seem as though that it's dragging. It's a massively atmospheric film. It's often quite beautiful, a very sharp script with layered, grizzled characters, and personally I think it's never less than roundly awesome.
Well, I would tend to agree with you, Scott, in that it's roundly awesome, but a little bit earlier on, during our off-the-record preamble, I detected a voice of dissent amongst the ranks. Drew, as far as you're concerned, Unforgiven is a steaming hile of fetid horse cack, is it not?
No.
You said you didn't like it. Surely that's yes. A famous point, an unremitting pile of steaming fetid horse cack.
There are no grey areas.
Yes, you're entirely right. They're entirely synonymous, Craig. Entirely synonymous.
Good. I'm glad I called it for you and made you realise the errors of your way. Or error of your ways, whichever one's most convenient. And or grammatically correct.
Possibly,
yeah, you didn't
neither.
Like it very much, it's safe to say.
I remember having tried to watch it quite some time ago. It must have been not long after it came out, I suppose, and I remember being bored rigid by it. But since then, my tastes and appreciations have matured and changed massively. So I watched it again recently, and I still don't think it's a bad film, and I enjoyed the performances. I was just rather underwhelmed by it, given the reputation it has and the way it's regarded by most other people, including you and Scott.
Yes. What didn't you like about it?
You would ask me the question I'm struggling to elaborate on. I don't know.
I don't shy away from the tough talk.
I don't know, there's not any one thing, there was nothing that was badly done about it, nothing I particularly didn't like, I just never particularly felt engaged by the story at any point.
So yeah, I can almost see that in the sense that it's not really the story that's what's great to me about this film, it's purely the characters in it.
Yeah, it's purely the characters and their relationships.
It's just Gene Hackman, who's rarely less than incredible any time he's on frame, is just writes this lovely layered performance, and Eastwood himself as a man who's seemingly conquered his demons only to have them rising back up again is a more interesting character than you see in the majority of films, let alone westerns.
Yeah, exactly.
And I will temper it by the fact that when I did watch it again, it was on a very small portable television and at some ridiculous time, like 6 o'clock in the morning, possibly not the best time to appreciate it. But,
I didn't like this film because I saw it at 6 o'clock on a portable TV.
And?
And there was a westerly wind outside, so you know I was going to hate it.
Oh. My point being that it was on a small screen, it's not particularly conducive to enjoying any views of cinematography, and possibly quite tired by the time I watched it. But
why didn't you just sit closer to the telly? I believe at that size of television, if you sat a mere inch and a half away from the screen, it would replicate the full splendour of the cinema experience. Albeit in a slightly smudgy, grainy fashion.
You are, of course, right again.
I myself, as always, as a miserable git, found myself drawn to the sort of unremitting bleakness of it all. And in particular, Scott, you mentioned Clint Eastwood's sort of... It's the inverse of the usual character arc you would find in a story of this type. And traditionally, Westerns tend to fall into two categories. They can either be a pain to the passing of the Old West into the modern world, which is usually signalled by, you know, sort of railways and all that jazz. I'm thinking Once Upon a Time in the West. Or you can have tales of personal redemption. And Unforgiven sort of takes, like you say, a story which has essentially already culminated in personal redemption and flips it around and says, oh, look, this man's becoming a pain in the ass again. Well, not a pain in the ass, he's becoming just a nasty piece of work again. And as far as I'm concerned, that's just awesome.
A deeply amoral person whose true self just becomes resurrected. Yeah,
exactly. Essentially, he's achieved peace by living a lie.
See,
that's the state he's in at the start of the film, and by the end of the film, he's just basically let it go and said, you know what, I am what I am, and what I am is just a bit of a monster. And I'm not going to make any more apologies for it, and I'm going to signal this by shooting Gene Hackman in the face with both barrels of a shotgun.
Yeah, what I would say, I mean, having said that I didn't enjoy it particularly, I was rather underwhelmed by it. I mean, so many of the elements in it are things that I really appreciate, and I appreciate in other films, particularly Westerns. So I just think perhaps it was a bad day that I watched it. And certainly I'd be prepared to watch it again, so I would suggest to anybody listening who had seen it but didn't think all that much of it to give it another go. Because things like the bleakness you mentioned, Craig, I mean, I love that in films. And things like Ang Lee's Brokeback Mountain, everything's very understated, and not an awful lot happens in that film, but it's still fantastic. Mm. So I think I would be prepared to give Unforgiven another go, and anybody who felt similarly to me, I would suggest to give it another go, because I suspect it would be worth it.
I mean, I must say, I'm not actually the biggest Western fan. I suspect I'm probably least enamoured with them of the people talking here. And it's certainly my favourite Western by a fair bit. So I don't know what that counts for, but it certainly does it for me.
I can only name a couple of other Westerns which I like more than Unforgiven. And I wouldn't say I like them massively more. It's quite a close run thing. Drew, you're going to have to watch it again. You're going to have to realise that you're wrong. podcast@oneline.com is the address to send your emails to if you want to tell Drew just how wrong he is. And with any luck, we can perform some sort of, linguistic reprogramming of his brain as he reads through your emails. You can point out to him and hopefully recode his thoughts. Most recently, of course, going from the least recent of the films to the most recent, which we've seen at the cinema, there is Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Drew, can you fill us in on the basic premise?
Yes, well, it's rather long and unwieldy title tells you quite a lot about the basic premise of the film. It's quite a descriptive title. It's, curiously enough, about the assassination of Jesse James by Robert Ford. Robert Ford...
Was he a coward?
Well, you know, he was. Oh. Considered. There's no layer depth in the title of that film. It's purely descriptive.
Excellent. And it's only just shorter than the screenplay.
Indeed. The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, Brad Pitt's latest film. It stars Brad Pitt as the titular Jesse James, well-known Western outlaw, and Casey Affleck plays Robert Ford, the young man whose brothers had been involved in various nefarious activities with the James gang for a few years, and having met him on a couple of occasions and spent many years of his youth reading the pulp fiction comics of the day and crappy novellas about Jesse James, he'd come to idolise him and hero worship him. Yeah, Ford's idolisation of Jesse James finally begins to turn to resentment and then anger, and he takes it upon himself to assassinate Jesse James, which you may have guessed was going to happen from the title.
Or from any number of history books.
Possibly.
It's a possibility.
The film follows the relationship between Ford, his brother Charlie, and the rest of the James gang, and the dissolution of their friendship and the betrayals they have, and obviously culminate in Ford's assassination of Jesse James and his subsequent celebrity status, then vilification.
And what did you think of the film in general, Drew? Were you quite drawn to it in the way that lots of critics have been, or did you find yourself strangely detached?
I did feel quite detached, but it didn't mean I didn't like it. Again, I'm like yourself, Greg, and I really would like to see it again because I can't make up my mind about it at all. And it's beautifully shot.
This was a problem for me, that spending a lot of my spare time mucking about with my camera. What I tend to notice most these days is I tend to focus first on cinematography. It's quite simply one of the most fantastically shot films I've seen in recent years. I'm not going to bore people with technical terminology and stuff, but basically, if you are a fan of stuff with lenses stuck on it, You've pretty much got to go and see The Assassination of Jesse James. However, I found myself sort of being so, fawning over that I'm not entirely sure whether I picked up on the rest of the film. I was aware that I largely enjoyed it. However, given the kudos that has been drawn in general and sort of speak of awards and things, I would like to go back and see it again because I wasn't viewing it on that kind of a level. I was a little bit distracted by how good it looks.
I was a bit distracted because Roger Deakins' cinematography is beautiful and it's really quite captivating. And I did spend a lot of the time thinking, ooh, that's pretty. Which, it's fair enough to say, though, that there is time to do that because it's not the fastest paced film you'll ever see.
No. I tell you what did stick out, though, what you can't help but notice, and it irks me a little bit that I think Brad Pitt has already... Brad Pitt gives an excellent performance. I think he's already picked up one award for. It wasn't at Cannes, was it? Was it at the Venice Film Festival? Or he picked up a Best Actor award somewhere along the line, I think. But that he picked it up over and above Casey Affleck seemed a bit unjust to me, because the one thing that did stick out to me was just how good a performance Casey Affleck gives. It was one of the best performances I've seen in... this year, pretty much. Anybody else want to comment on that?
This is the kind of film that puts me in mind of The Assassination of Richard Nixon as well. I didn't enjoy that film either, but I can kind of see why people would like it. The characters in it are really just not likeable at all. You know, what with all the murders and all, they're not particularly likeable guys and don't really want to know any more about them. However, you can't help the fact, I think Brad Pitt did give an excellent performance. I think Casey Affleck put in an excellent performance. Ooh, that Affleck. But also, should mention Sam Rockwell as well, who I never hear mentioned in this film at all. And you've not seen him for a while. I don't think he's been in films lately. And I thought that was a tremendous return for him. I thought he did very well in this film as well. Almost Absolutely. As good as Affleck. It's a very well-acted film, but I don't know, the characters are so repulsive that I just don't really want to know too much about them. And as mentioned, it is so sedately faced that it often feels like it's going backwards in time.
Yeah, the thing there about the characters too, so I wonder if it does play differently in America, because the film continues and shows that having originally been a hero for killing this great murderer that Jesse James was, Ford finally becomes vilified by people who end up preferring Jesse James, and that sort of thing's happened in America a couple of times, and it's certainly happened in Australia too, that a couple of the big folk heroes are the most abysmal people. Ned Kelly was a deeply, deeply unpleasant man who is probably one of the most unpleasant people you could ever hope to avoid meeting.
Well, from the point of view of being three Scotsmen as well, I always look at Braveheart and think, well, from what I gather from such terse learning materials as history books, William Wallace was a bit of an arse as well.
Yeah, well, that's probably a bit different in that he was a soldier, and he was a brutal, brutal person, and possibly some of it's not excusable. Yes, but to do what he needed to do, that was perhaps, to some extent anyway, necessary. I mean, it's not really the point to go into the discussion of this, but...
that's a podcast for another day.
Jesse James was just an out-and-out criminal. He was a murderer and a robber.
Just throwing as a point of procedure, the director of this is Andrew Dominik, who, as far as I'm aware, was last seen doing 2000's Chopper, which is a similar sort of focus on a criminal. So,
and a folklore hero.
Indeed.
Yes, but it's perhaps something to do with it. Yeah, the acting is fantastic. Brad Pitt managed a very good job of... You can see the charm that Jesse James would have had, the way he plays him, why people would have liked him, but you can also, just beneath that, there's a sense of menace and instability. You just know he could snap and kill you at any point.
Well, I know why the women liked him. They were all going about thinking, oh, he looks just like Brad Pitt. But no, in all serious note, I mean, I take Scott's point on board about basically they are villainous shits, but they are very interesting villainous shits. It's not often a film is brave enough to sort of take the time to explore its characters a bit before very much happens. I know it's going to turn a lot of people off, and there are probably going to be a lot of people who go in to see this who walk out after the first hour saying, this is crap. But I think it's one of these films, I suspect it very much depends upon what frame of mind you're in at the time. Yeah. I've got a sneaking suspicion if I go back and watch it again, I'm going to really enjoy it.
I think it would be a great pit if they walked out after the first hour, because when it gets towards the end of this film, or I suppose it's the second, third maybe, where it's building up to the actual assassination, it does manage to build quite a lot of tension in there. I found myself really enjoying the kind of build-up to the day when you knew that he was going to actually shoot him. And that bit is really interesting. It's just the book ending of that I felt was a bit far too ponderously placed, if I'm honest. And I did like the film overall. It's not a bad film by any stretch of the imagination. I couldn't bring myself to sort of start shoveling superlatives onto it the same way that quite a lot of other people have.
I really would like to see it again, because I can't make up my mind about it. But I did see an interview with Brad Pitt in which he described the film as meditative, and I think that's quite a good word, actually. If you go in expecting something similar to Love Otherwise, and perhaps a bit more action, you will be disappointed. But meditative, and I would say perhaps contemplative.
I have a theory that it may well depend upon how drawn you are towards characters who are, like you say, Scott, sort of quite without redeeming features, and whether or not, not necessarily empathise with them, because I wouldn't to any extent say I empathise with any of the characters, but I've always been interested in people like that. It's always fascinated me. And I think it's one of these things where I think possibly a lot of people, if you're repelled by people like that, or if you can't contemplate them at all without sort of thinking, oh, you know, what a nasty piece of work, I think you'll probably find this isn't a film for you, regardless of how sedately paced it is or otherwise. Whereas if you're interested in people who are, say interested in making myself sound like some sort of closet psychopath here, but I've always been interested by characters who are essentially without redeeming feature, because how do you explore a character who you can't empathise with? I think if you appreciate that kind of a predicament to be in, I think you'll probably get a lot more out of it. I mean, I myself, I'm drawn to characters like that. I quite enjoy that sort of thing. So I think if I go and watch it again, I strongly suspect I'm going to come out really enjoying it.
Yeah, so it's a sort of film that requires a little bit of detachment, I think, to view it, which is...
Yes, that's kind of exactly the word.
Perhaps the opposite of what I'm looking for, where I'd rather more be involved with a film and it's always trying to push you away, I thought, rather than draw you in, which that doesn't work for me, but I can see it working for other people.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's, despite it being the most recent of the films that we've seen, it's also perhaps the one that none of us really... I don't know, Drew, did you have a very definite opinion on it, or are you the same that you... I think you've already said, haven't you, that you think you're going to have to go back and watch it again?
Yes.
Yeah, so we can't actually give you a verdict on that one, folks. Sorry to have taken up your time.
I would give it 73%.
There we go. Scott would give it 73%. Drew?
I don't know. 12. Not percent, just 12.
Just 12.
Average few units.
I would certainly
hope that our listeners would have heard enough that it might intrigue them and would see what it was about. That there'd be enough elements there that'd want to see it. I mean, I would urge people to see it.
Go and see it. Let us know what you think.
So it's still not the sort of film I would say, like, don't watch it. It's awful. It's probably worth a watch at some point. Perhaps not in a cinema. I think it might, because it's so... I know you want to see it on a quite big screen because of cinematography, but it's sort of one of those films that might suit itself quite well to just sitting down on an afternoon and watching it on a television.
Quite possibly.
A weekend, Sunday afternoon perhaps you watch that because it's quite slow and it kind of suits the feel of that day and that time perhaps.
Well, there we go. We'll get back to you at such a time as we can make up our mind about it. Open Range is an interesting beast. Kevin Costner was doing quite well after Dances with Wolves, and then he went and made Waterworld. And then he went and made The Postman. And nobody wanted to hear from him ever again. Open Range represents his first foray into directing since that disastrous effort back in 1997. Did either of you guys see The Postman?
No, I did not.
Thankfully managed to dodge that bullet.
Oh, do yourselves a favour and don't ever bump into it in a dark alley. It's a slow-burning tale of a cattle crew forced to seek vengeance against bent lawmen and an evil rancher who together threaten to unsettle the group's peaceful existence. Again, very much like Assassination of Jesse James, it's quite a slow-burning number, and for that reason a lot of people are probably going to fall asleep before it really kicks off. But by Jove, when it does, what a film it is. I, for one, thought this was one of the best, possibly the best of the westerns I've seen recently. Guys, what did you think?
I enjoyed it for the entirety of the film. I just loved the slow burn. It's why, perhaps, it's strange I didn't enjoy Unforgiven. But I just loved the slow burn nature. Just the performance was pitched absolutely perfectly. It was just an entertaining story. It looked pretty. I liked it from the beginning, and it's certainly one of the best of the westerns I've seen in quite some time.
Yeah, it's starting to sound a bit like a broken record, but it is, again, another film with a great score, beautiful cinematography and great performances, and yes, we'll be saying this quite a lot, but it is a slow burn, but it's a very rewarding burn, and when the burning of Dutch paper actually hits the explosions, oh my God.
It's certainly, it's worthwhile sitting down. I think, what does it run to, about 2 hours 20, 2.5 hours or something like that?
Yeah,
Just a tad over 2 hours, isn't it? But by Jove, is it worth the wait for the final couple of reels, it all kicks off and it's just, you think, oh yeah, this is why I came to see a Western. I think I would suggest that, sedately paced as it is, it's not as long as Assassination of Jesse James, or I don't think it's even as long as Unforgiven. Mm-hmm. But again, it's a film of the length where people are more likely to be put off. But what I would say is if you found a characterisation too dark in Unforgiven or Assassination of Jesse James, you're more likely to enjoy Open Range, I think, because the characters are more immediately identifiable and I think they're far more...
It's a little
easy
more,
to feel empathy
little more
for.
White hat, black hat, isn't it? Gambon's pretty much just sort of, oh, I'm evil, I don't like you.
And, it's infinitely more accessible.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, there are hints to him, and they're obviously both Boss Spearman, who's Robert Duvall's character, and Charlie, which is Kevin Costner, both clearly have a history, which is just vaguely alluded to. But you get the feeling like they've put that behind them, they just want to work an honest job now.
Yeah, yeah. Charlie
in particular
always feels.
I suppose Bill Money begins in Unforgiven. But it's like, you get, they're just sort of regular Joes, they're working hard, trying to make a living off the land, and people are doing harm to them when they've done nothing to deserve it. So you can engage with that quite quickly and quite easily.
Yeah. And again, it's another one of these death of a lifestyle kind of things, not so much the whole Western way as much, but in particular practice of free grazing.
Mm. Yeah, it's a kind of a nice combination between the passing of an era and story of redemption tales, isn't it? They kind of meet halfway in this one. It's almost like Unforgiven in the sense that Kevin Costner's character has already reached some sort of redemption, and he has to go back and it's not played on too much. Don't let that pay off. He does have to go back and sort of confront a darker side of his nature to reach another resolution and finally be completely free. Whereas Clint Eastwood's character in Unforgiven just sort of disappeared down the dark path and said, oh, well, that's it for me. Open Range kind of balances it a bit more. It walks more of a tightrope than that, and it doesn't disappear down that path, but it also doesn't necessarily disappear down the cliched path of starting out a bit of a nasty character and then being redeemed.
Yeah. Another good performance from Annette Bening, I thought, as a kind of romantic interest in it, which we're not seeing an awful lot of in the rest of these films that we'll be talking about, so it's nice to see at least some attempt at male-female interaction.
Yeah, but
it's certainly the most traditional of the films, isn't it? And that's one respect that I hadn't actually thought of. And is it the only film in amongst the lot we're going to speak about tonight with any love interest, isn't it?
Pretty much.
In a traditional sense.
Yeah, there's maybe something you could allude to in the Three Burials from Melquiades Estrada, but not really. Yeah, it's pretty much only kind of traditional-ish romance.
Maybe that's why we liked it so much. We're just sensitive guys.
It's quite a pleasing film too, in that Kevin Costner by no means is a great actor, but he's certainly not a bad actor either. But if you saw these films from the mid-90s, you might be thinking to think otherwise. You know, other rubbish he's done, like...
You might be thinking, where's all the baseball?
Yeah.
Well, the Guardian.
I don't know whether it's the fact that he was sort of cautious about coming back with something like this, but he does seem to play... I don't want to say he plays a very safe character. I think it's more a case of he plays quite safely within his strengths. I think he doesn't try and stretch himself too much. But what he puts back to the fore is a sort of his old shtick as being quite a visual director. He's quite capable of giving you a sense of the sort of epic nature of just how big a thing the West used to be. The whole idea of the West with Dances with Wolves, obviously one of the Oscars it picked up was a cinematography Oscar, wasn't it? I might be entirely wrong on that. I think it might have been. And again, he sort of concentrates, he spends, there's lots of languishing shots of landscapes and sunsets and things like that. And that's what I suppose he kind of sticks quite safely in that respect as well, doesn't he? He doesn't overdo it, but he sticks to what he has proven has worked for him, and it works again here.
Yeah, I don't know, but when you're talking about his actor, I don't know that so much the character, whereas Charlie's, he always plays his cards quite close to his chest. There's only a couple of scenes where you see it kind of busting out as some kind of emotion, like where he slaps the young kid off his horse for I forget exactly what it was, he was disrespecting something.
Cheating at cards.
Yeah, that was it. He was offended his sense of morals, so he's knocked off his horse. But other than that, he tends to play himself quite quietly. And I don't know, that's probably something to do with it.
I mean, I would certainly, I'm not going to sit in the fence. Of the films, Unforgiven aside, of the films that we speak of tonight, I think Open Range is probably my favourite. Where would you place it in the standing, lads?
I would concur with that wholeheartedly.
I would say of the films we're going to discuss tonight, that it would be my favourite.
So there we go, fairly strong recommendation. If you've read my excellent review on theoneliner.com, you'd know that anyway.
Shameless self-publication.
Absolutely. Of some interest, initially, is Seraphim Falls, directed by David von Anken, in which trapper Pierce Brosnan is pursued relentlessly by an irate Liam Neeson, of all people, and his posse through snowy woodland, barren desert, and everything in between. We are, for the most part, blissfully unaware of the reasons why, the film adopting what it would no doubt like to think is an inventive flashback narrative structure, with clues as to the reasons for Neeson's pursuit slowly drip-fed. I was expecting better things of this, and at the end of the day, I thought it was the proverbial steaming pile of cack. Scott, what saith ye?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but it's certainly the least of the films we'll be talking about. I thought I was actually drawn in by the start. I mean, for the first 20 minutes, it is a pure chase stroke stalking film. And all you really see is Brosnan huffing and puffing and groaning and screaming, and there's about four actual words of dialogue in it until then. It did actually sucker me into going, what's going on here? And it kept me going for about 90 minutes. Some reasonable performances, certainly most of the characterizations coming from facial expressions rather than long soliloquies. And I thought that was kind of interesting, but towards the end, the final reel just sort of fades away into oblivion. And fairly arbitrarily descends into what I guess is metaphor or symbolism or just plain bad.
I'm sure it's symbolism.
It doesn't conclude so much as just stop. And it's a deeply unsatisfying ending to a film which has some redeeming features at the start, but by the time you get to the end, it's not worth it. And I was quite disappointed by it. I just don't really see what the point of it was.
Drew, can you add to that?
Yeah, well, I felt largely the same. I was really quite enjoying the beginning of it, quite intrigued, actually. You just get little hints of what the deal was between Liam Neeson and Pierce Brosnan, and both Brosnan and Neeson managed to do quite a good job of acting quite physically without having to say much. There's Neeson, partly because of his stature, I guess, you get quite a sort of definable sense of power from him, and he's someone not to be messed with. And Pierce Brosnan, too, his acting is mostly physical, which, from the point of view of how bad both Liam Neeson and Pierce Brosnan's accents are in it, is probably quite a good thing, that you don't hear them speak much for quite some time. It's certainly very intriguing. You want to know what's happening, and you're wondering, oh, as the film begins with Pierce Brosnan being attacked while he's just trying to make his dinner, you're thinking, well, does he have this coming, or is he being persecuted? Should I feel sorry for him? And it keeps that going for quite a while. You just get snippets of why Liam Neeson is chasing Pierce Brosnan. But as soon as you find out why, the film almost grinds to a halt before it gets sort of slightly trippy at the end. And I had been really quite enjoying it up to that point, thinking, yeah, physically the acting's rather entertaining. Yeah, please don't speak. No, please, no, don't speak, don't speak. Ah, the accents. But,
is this a nightmare you had, Drew?
No, it was this film. You've seen it.
Yeah, the only thing I'm taking away from this film is it's a timely reminder that Pierce Brosnan can actually act after, you know, years of smiling coquettishly and jumping into invisible cars as Bond and having to do very little in the way of actual emotive things. This is a bit better, but other than that, not a film I'm going to be looking at again.
I can't say I'd forgotten that Pierce Brosnan could act, but I'll tell you, the only thing the film did of any use, as far as I'm concerned, and Drew touched upon it there, is that it toys with this notion that we have that when the pursuit begins, we automatically assume that the lone man being pursued is obviously, is obviously the hero, purely because he seems to be facing such adversity. I think I don't want to use the word clever. It's almost clever what David Von Anken and the screenwriter, who I can't remember their name, are trying to achieve there, and that they're playing with your notion of presumption. And you think, oh God, what's happening here? I better side with Pierce Brosnan because look, oh, he's... And actually, as it turns out, Pierce Brosnan kind of does have it coming, in a sense. But other than that, you say, Scott, it kept you going for about 90 minutes. It kept me going for about, I don't know, 10 minutes. And then I started to think, you know, this is living on borrowed time. It's playing too much in this notion of, oh, let's make the start really interesting. It could never sustain that. And it was shot through with the kind of production value and the kind of cinematography. I could not get it out of my head that I just thought, this thing looks like it's been shot as a Sunday movie, you know, TV movie special.
I think the one thing that annoyed me was that I got very little sense of geography from this film. Because, I mean, at the start, they're running through snowbanks, and about what seems like 2 days later, they're in the middle of a desert. And I could never quite get my head around, where are these people? What are they doing? Why is everything so suddenly different? I didn't get much of a sense of time. I didn't get much of a sense of place in it, which is probably two of the things you really want from a Western.
Yeah, definitely. No, I couldn't take anything really redeeming from Seraphim Falls. I was looking forward to it, and it did intrigue me, admittedly, for 15, 20 minutes. You know, you notice how that estimate's doubled there from my initial statement of 10. I'll say it gave me 20 minutes of enjoyment, and then after that... But like you say, I did a very good physical performance from Pierce Brosnan, and Liam Neeson didn't sort of ham it up as much as he has on a lot of occasions. So... It's not all bad, but I didn't really like it very much at all.
No, I mean, I'm certainly not going to defend it much. It's, as I say, it's easily the least of the films we'll be talking about. It's certainly not one I'm ever going to look at again.
Yeah. Don't waste your time with this, guys, basically, is what we're telling you. The Proposition, directed by John Hillcoat, is set in the late 19th century in Australia, and the hot, dusty calm of the outback is shattered by the brutal murder of an entire family by notorious outlaw Arthur Burns and his gang. Local English lawman, Captain Stanley, played by Rye Winston, wades into the fray and makes a titular proposition to Arthur's captured younger brother, Charlie. Either he can kill his older sibling within 9 days or witness the execution of his youngest brother, Mike. Noted for its harsh, frequently brutal demeanour, excellent performances, and a screenplay and haunting musical score courtesy of one Nick Cave, of all people, The Proposition is a new twist on genre conventions that disappointed some popcorn-friendly audiences, but left critics fawning. I thought it was reasonably good. Drew, could you expand on that?
I thought it was reasonably good also. Or do you want a bit more expansion?
A little bit more expansion, even.
As you wish.
I mean, in the context of critics all seem to universally think, this is great. I wasn't quite that enthusiastic about it. Do you share my opinion?
I wouldn't say great. I would say very good, though. I very much enjoyed it. I liked the way it looked. And even just simple things, the fact that it was Australian,
yes,
made it a bit different because you weren't so familiar with the... perhaps how the story would go, certainly the people, the settings, which made it pleasantly different.
I think I liked it probably more than you guys. It's difficult to explain exactly why, given a lot of it's taken up with characters just staying silent and perfecting their 1,000-yard stares into the camera, and punctuated by the occasional bout of massively unpleasant graphic violence and John Hurt laughing about monkeys. there's just elements in there. You've got Cave's soundtrack is by turns beautiful, melodic, desolate, discordant. I thought it was very good. Guy Pearce is great, Danny Houston's great, Ray Winstone surprisingly is great. They kind of all just merge together. I can't quite explain why it works so well, given that there's certainly things to not like in it. There is a lot of places where it's very sedately paced and not an awful lot happens, but when things do happen, you certainly know about it.
Yeah, it seems to alternate between sort of dusty barren contemplation and stupendous violence. It's very bleak, and again, it's filled with characters who are in no way imbued with redeeming features.
Yes, and it doesn't even have the redeeming feature of you get to know an awful lot about them, where in this one you don't. A lot of it, again, is just Danny Houston sort of sitting on the edge of some rocks going, "Oof, crikey, I'm evil," and then going off and shooting someone in the head. But I don't know, it just kind of works for me. I can't really explain why, but it's certainly one of my favourite films of the last few years.
I'll tell you what, it's a single biggest selling point for me, and you can call me shallow here. As you just touched on there, Scott, it does feature one half of a man's head exploding.
It's a good shot.
That's worth £6.50 in my book.
There's a lot of pink mist, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, the other thing too is, having not really been that aware of him before that, it opened my eyes to Danny Houston, who I thought was fantastic in it, and I've been on the lookout for him in other things since.
Most recently, 30 Days of Night.
Yeah, exactly. That was a revelation to me. I hadn't really heard of him. He just appears in this film. He'd done The Aviator, not a big role, I think, just before it, but Dan Houston appears in this. "Hello, I'm Dan Houston. I'm great." Where have you been hiding all these years then? Where have you been in all these other films you could have made better by being in them?
Yeah, no, he certainly plays a very, very good role. That's probably the thing I enjoyed the most about the proposition. Well, it's probably... It's a toss-up between Nick Cave's score but the other would be the performances, definitely. And like you say, Scott, even in brash, sort of snarling mode, what's his chops manages to be. It's one of his better roles, probably his best performance since Sexy Beast. Actually,
I don't know. It's probably that alongside Cold Mountain is one of the two best things I've seen Ray Winstone in quite some time, and along with Cold Mountain. So one of the things, he doesn't, for the most part, play Ray Winston, which is always a pleasant change.
You know,
most
or Beowulf.
Starring Ray Winston as Ray Winston.
See, now you're saying Cold Mountain, but I couldn't abide it in the first place, so that doesn't count as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, he's certainly better than Beowulf, put it that way.
I'm not sure, but maybe what I find interesting is it seems to be not quite a more modern take on a Western. That's provided by Three Birds of Macaddy's Estrada, but it does feel, it has that sort of modern sensibilities transplanted onto the face of an old, fairly standard story, more or less. It's not a million miles away from Unforgiven in terms of its structure, but it's a lot harsher, it's a lot nastier, it's a lot grittier. It feels less idealised than a lot of Westerns, which can't get, I mean, especially older Westerns.
Do you know what I think is possibly the best way to describe it? And you used it to describe Nick Cave's score, Scott, earlier on, and I think actually it might be the best assessment of the film as well. You've sort of come across there. I think it's very discordant.
Yeah.
I think the whole film's very discordant. It's at a completely different tempo, and it hits a completely different beat to everything else, and that's not necessarily just due to the setting, because you probably won't have seen a Western set in Australia before. You don't think Western and then think Australia, do you? But the whole film is very... If you want something different of a Western, this is the film you want to see out of all the ones we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, but I don't know if there's anything to the fact that maybe it is the fact that I'm not... I would classify myself as not so enamoured with Westerns as you two, and I find myself liking this a lot more because maybe it feels a little bit less like a Western than a lot of the other ones we're talking about.
The least traditional of them are certainly the most just disjointed or displaced of them all.
Yeah, there's an element of chaos that appeals to me, I think.
Definitely, we all like chaos. It's a Western tending towards entropy. No, I certainly, I think if you want something different, I could certainly recommend The Proposition. Again, I wouldn't hold it up there against Open Range necessarily, but then it's two different audiences entirely, whereas Open Range is certainly a sort of a comfortable, what I'd call a classic Western proposition. I think you hit it on the head, Scott. It's very discordant, it's very modern.
Yeah,
as modern as a film set in this period can be.
Yeah, I mean, now I'm actually thinking about it, I'm not sure why I put it in this list, because if someone came to me and asked for a recommendation for a Western, I probably wouldn't have given them The Proposition, because it doesn't feel much like a Western to me.
No.
You know, setting regardless of it is very much the genre it falls, it is sort of looking at, but yeah, it is certainly the least traditional of them, and maybe shouldn't I actually have been covered in this podcast, so I apologise for mentioning it in the first place.
So certainly though, if people are willing to take it, that this is, that you can classify this as a Western, then I think that's certainly one that I would recommend.
Certainly a very good film. I very much like it.
Yeah, me also.
It's more than I can say of the last film on our list, not because I disliked it, but because I haven't seen it to either like it or dislike it. What I can do, dear listeners, is tell you a bit about it, and then ask if Scott and Drew have any opinions on it, and then let you make up your own mind as to whether or not it's something you'd like to invest your time in. Does that sound good? Okay. It's directed by Tommy Lee Jones, who also stars in the film, and it concerns a naive border patrolman who mistakenly kills the Mexican cowboy Melquiades Estrada and buries him without ceremony in the Texan desert. The local ranch owner Pete Perkins, Tommy Lee Jones, who's the deceased's best friend, forces him to exhume the body and accompany him on a quest to return Melquiades to his Mexican hometown. It was released to little fanfare, nonetheless earning Tommy Lee Jones numerous awards nominations as both actor and director, as well as nods in the direction of screenwriter Guillermo Arriaga. 2 years after its release, it's already considered a modern classic by many, and seems likely to go down in history as one of those forgotten gems that crops up on 10 best lists. But is it really that good? I can't offer you an opinion, if I'm being honest. However, I know two men who can. Scott, what can you tell me about it?
Well, again, it's another one of my favourite films the last couple of years, so that probably tells you a thing or two about it. It's, you could roughly categorise it as some sort of coming-of-age, come-buddy comedy kind of film, with, laced with applied nastiness. It has a grizzled veteran teaching the irresponsible, impudent young pup a thing or two about responsibility, and the Mike, who's the Barry Pepper character who shoots Melquiades, certainly deserves his rough justice. For a while, at least, there's a point in Three Burials where the scales of justice sort of tip, and the experience that Pete is making Mike endure, if it's not hell, it's a kind of purgatory with spiky bits, and it does seem to be a lot nastier than a guy who just made a mistake deserves. There's a point where it looks like the Barry Pepper character that Mike's about to just break totally, and it, Pete goes from, has a kind of nice oscillating character between obviously being the hero of the piece and then kind of getting towards being a fairly nasty villain towards the end of it before it kind of balances itself back out again. It's good for a lot of things. It's an interesting story. Jones gives a commendably restrained performance in a role that could have gone into cartoon villainy, and instead Pete gets a kind of desperate vulnerability, which is quite endearing. As I say, it does kind of endearing at the start and kind of passes through to a kind of more worrying territory around about the same time as bits of Melquiades Estrada starts falling off due to decomposition.
Nice.
Pepper's carrying the emotional heart of the film. He does quite well. He plays Mike at the start as a very unsympathetic character, and when his sort of change comes and when he sort of realises what he's done and how bad a boy he's been, you can feel sort of sympathy for him. There's moments of beautiful characterisation, although the plot itself is somewhat skeletal. But it's a lovely thing to watch just unfold. It's not the most eventful film you'll see. Again, it's I hate to use the phrase again, it is a bit of a slow burn, but I think it's worth watching. It's certainly one of the more interesting takes on the genre.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with almost all of that, or probably all of it, in fact. It was one of the most enjoyable films I saw that year, and it's a very interesting character piece, and it's one of those things like Crime and Punishment, and it makes you think, leaves you thinking after you leave the film about the nature of crime and punishment, whether what's just and what's not. There's not too much more to add. It's a very enjoyable film. It leaves you thinking quite a bit about the idea of crime and punishment, sort of, because Barry Pepper's character is deeply unpleasant. He makes a mistake, but how he deals with that mistake is not good, and he was a pretty unpleasant character to begin with, as it's shown at many points in the film. But you're like, what's too much?
Yeah, I mean, it's a film that does, I've said it before quite a lot of times today, it's got great performances. It is a very slow-burning thing. I think what else you want to say about it? It's a very bleak film. It's arguably the bleakest of all of them, not just because it's about carrying a dead body, but it is...
Actually, that is quite bleak, isn't it?
I mean, it is a fairly bleak film, I would say. I can't think of too many bleaker films I've seen of late.
I would say it was bleak for some point, but it doesn't end bleakly. It doesn't end like you think it might. And I think that makes it a better film.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not as you'd expect. And again, it's the ending leaves you thinking about what has happened. And it's quite a rare thing nowadays for a film to actually make you think so much and to leave you thinking about it afterwards. And not just about the film, but about the issues the film raises.
Yeah,
it's unfortunately uncommon. It's one of the few that manages to do it.
It's certainly one of my favourite films. It's a film I kind of go back to more than quite a lot of other films that I've seen. I do tend to find myself liking this quite a lot more. So yeah, you can make of that what you will.
Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada sounds to me like it might be worth investing in. Although it seems like we're saying how great all these new modern westerns are, but it sounds like quite a lot of them are unremittingly bleak.
that's very much the modern age, isn't it? The days of the carefree, happy John Wayne westerns where they're getting off their horse and drinking their milk seems to have passed. I'm not sure I'm particularly unhappy about that. That's why I didn't watch westerns as a kid. I found them all a bit, even at that age, I thought that was a bit cliched and trite. I welcome a bit more grit in my diet. So
Once upon a time in the West wasn't gritty enough.
Oh, there are exceptions,
what,
of course.
What but, with children being shot.
Ah, but that was like the first sort of renaissance of the Western, wasn't it? Sergio Leone, that sort of time. It's different from the John Wayne, John Ford type of era.
You know, most of the Westerns I can remember growing up were basically circling the wagons and shooting some engines, because god damn those engines.
Yeah, they were all very much rawhide.
Yes, which isn't really my cup of tea. It just seemed kind of insulting to my intelligence even then. Whereas now they're getting treated with a bit more maturity and a bit more respect, which I obviously...
Well, I was going to say, as a difference here, and perhaps a renaissance can be explained by the fact that finally maybe Westerns are being credited with the intelligence they deserve, and that they aren't just simple shoot-em-ups about Indians and cowboys. They're actually offering themes and content over and above simply... people running about going, and other people trying to shoot them.
Yeah, I mean, the Western, I probably don't know enough to talk about this in any great length, but it did seem to be essentially an action film, whereas now you're more likely to have cops and robbers or SWAT or something like that. In the old days, you had cowboys and Westerns. I don't know.
The thought of SWAT, I hope we don't get a Colin Farrell crappy 12-rated action movie renaissance in 30 years' time. Oh, God. I hope I'm in a box by then.
It can be arranged.
Oh, what are friends for, eh? No, I just think I think maybe that's why people are more willing to go and see a Western now, is that you always did have the Sam Peckinpahs and the Sergio Leones at the time, but maybe they weren't appreciated at the time. Maybe they were ahead of their time, and it's only now that an intelligent Western can actually come to the fore and stand on its own two feet. People are willing to accept it as valuable a genre as any other, as valuable as drama, as valuable as... Well, it's only really dramas that win anything, isn't it? But certainly in terms of... they're no longer simple shoot-em-ups. They can be thought pieces as much as they can be action films. And maybe that's why people are so willing to go and see one now.
The way Westerns were in the past, I mean, I think they followed on from the sort of book that Robert Ford read in The Assassination of Jesse James. There were sort of yee-haw stories that they weren't really thought about. They weren't particularly realistic. And so they were pretty much just fluff action pieces, and the Westerns were one of the first type of films to get made in any sort of bulk after cinema really became the thing of the day. So I think that's perhaps why a lot of them are quite simplistic, although by no means all of them, but the majority. And also, it's something that I tend to forget when I'm watching Westerns, because the West was so different from Europe at the time. But imagine like the Westerns from like the early 1930s to 1940s. That's only a few decades after the actual events were happening.
Yeah, absolutely.
After the end of the Indian Wars and the expansion into the West. And you watch a Western set like 1900, and you're sure it must be a good 100 years earlier because it's so different to like the built-up cities of Europe that we're used to. So I wonder if perhaps because they were so close to and quite sensitive in some ways about what had happened and perhaps
in much the same way perhaps then that sort of the first batch of World War II films that came out were very much sort of comic book nonsense.
They were almost propaganda pieces.
Being too close to the fact, you need to be a bit more removed on the timeline before you can start to evaluate these things.
And to be more honest too, because if you look at things like the 1930s sort of things, and it's all just shooting Indians, Indians were the bad guys. Well, now you might actually see some films and things like Steven Spielberg production Into the West television series white Americans were pretty nasty to the Indians and really they were the victims, and obviously there would have been some crimes committed by the Indians for certain, but it's sort of more owned up to now that it wasn't the way around a John Wayne film might have painted it, but that tends to take time. Now we can like things like the counterfeiters, now German cinema is not feeling quite so sensitive about it, is it going back and exploring their history around about World War II. It's easier now with the time difference to restudy your history, perhaps correct what was done in the cinema in the past.
Well, there we go.
That's part of why Westerns were different in the beginning. So like now the time is passing, be a bit more intelligent, a bit more realistic perhaps.
I don't know about you guys, but having had this little discussion tonight, I'm really looking forward to the next batch of Westerns that come along.
I'll bet they all suck.
Yay!
It's now you've said that out loud, isn't it? They all suck.
I do apologise to fans of the genre, whom I have just so clearly hexed. So, thanks for listening once again, and for entertaining our own particular brand of, we'd like to think, witty, but it's probably not banter. I've been Craig Eastman in, well, just outside Liverpool, really. And I was joined tonight by Scott in Glasgow.
Fare thee well.
And, of course, Drew in Falkirk.
Adieu.
Adieu indeed. We'll speak to you all again soon. Take it easy. Keep it real.
I saw a film, it was good, it had people in it, and this is what happened.